John Pless, our next speaker, has been on the faculty for approximately 10 and a half years. He previously served as the chaplain, the pastor at the University of Minnesota, University Lutheran Chapel. John colloquized into the LCMS from the American Lutheran Church, one of the ELCA predecessor bodies, in 1983. John received his bachelor's degree from Texas Lutheran University in Seguin, Texas, and then a Master of Divinity degree from Trinity Lutheran in Columbus, Ohio. John has authored and or edited four books, the latest of which is Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today. He has also written, by my count, 55 different articles in journals and other publications. So I think he should change that middle initial from T to John P. Pless for prolific. John Prolific Pless. Or start his own publishing company, which might be Prolific Pless Press. In addition to being prolific, John is also ubiquitous. Ask him about a state and he can tell you where he has preached or taught. In fact, ask him about Shoehorn, North Dakota. He'll be able to tell you the name of the pastor, the size of the congregation, and also recite the address of the local cigar store. John is exceptionally well regarded by our student body. He has preached for 11 ordinations. He has a full complement of students that follow him around and really adore him. Even mimicking his choice of beer and food, even to the point of going to Madagascar with him. John is co-president of the International Laya Society. He is also a member of the LCMS Committee on the Sanctity of Human Life. John is universally regarded as the most eligible bachelor on our seminary's faculty. Of course, he's the only one. Finally, one of his hallmark distinctions, John is the eyes and ears of our new synodical president here on this campus. If you want to really know what's going on, ask John, but please after the paper. We welcome John.
Thanks, John. To be introduced by a colleague who is also a lawyer. Which brings to mind, a little incident here last week. A local attorney phoned President Winthy and made a request to our seminary president on behalf of a client. The client's cat apparently had died, and the woman wanted a funeral for the cat. And Dr. Winthy said, well, this just won't do. I could never do a funeral for a cat. The new CTCR document, together with all creatures, is ecologically encompassing, but it would not go that far. I'm a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastor. We've got a new Synod president. What would he think about it? I just can't do that. And later in the afternoon, the attorney called back, and the attorney said, well, this, my client really, really wants a funeral for a cat. And Dr. Winston, I talked to you this morning, I told you this is just against our practice, it would be doctrinally unsound, and liturgically we don't have anything at all in LSB to handle pet funerals. And the client said, well, or the attorney said, well, my client really, really wants a funeral for her cat. In fact, she says she's willing to give to the library fund $100,000 if you'll do a funeral. And President Winthy says, well, why didn't you tell me in the first place that the cat was Missouri Synod? Point of the story is, give money to the library to keep our president from doing liturgically reprehensible things. Well, I want to speak this afternoon about the assigned topic, Wilhelm Leah, His Voice Still Heard in Walther's Church. And I realize also that according to the schedule, we're running short on time, and so I may try to summarize at least a section of the paper. If not, you'll miss chapel, and Dr. Scare says that's forgivable, so we'll see. 3 years ago, riding on the bicentennial of Leah's birth, Dr. Craig Nesson of Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque suggested two trajectories of the Neuendettelsel pastor's influence in contemporary Lutheranism, one through the Iowa Synod and then into the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the other through the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Given the fact that the Iowa Synod merged with the Ohio and Buffalo Synods to form the Old American Lutheran Church in 1930, which would join with other bodies to form the American Lutheran Church in 1960, and finally the ELCA in 1988, Nesson observed that Leah's influence is mainly discerned in his own church body, within those institutions, Wartburg Seminary and Wartburg College, both in Iowa, initially connected with Leah's work. Apart from these institutions, there was little, if any, recognition of the Leah anniversary in 2008 in the ELCA. By way of contrast, Nesson notes that as the 200th anniversary of Leah's birth is celebrated in 2008, Leah is being reclaimed as an important ancestor in the history and life of the LCMS. In 1949, Hermann Sasse, in one of his letters to Lutheran pastors, would observe that one of the most grievous events in the history of the Lutheran Church in the 19th century was the fact that the two great churchmen, Wilhelm Leah and C.F.W. Walther, went separate ways after the great theological leader of the Missouri Synod had in 1851 a most promising meeting with Leah in Neuendettelsel. Sasse's words echo the deep pathos that surrounds these two men who seemingly shared so much in common within the context of the confessional revival of their day. This paper will seek only in part to rehearse the history of how Walther and Leah would make common cause in their tireless efforts for confessional Lutheranism in the mid-19th century in the context of North America, and then chronicle the details of the fracture. In the main, it will examine how it how it is that Leah's voice continues to be heard in the church body that received its theological and ecclesial shape from his contemporary, C.F.W. Walther. And here I think I will try to summarize the first section in interest of time. I think most of us are familiar with the linkage between Leah and Walther running through Friedrich Winnicken in Passion Plea in 1840, distress of German Lutherans in North America, how this plea captures Leah's attention, and Leah begins to almost immediately set forces in motion to mobilize assistance for German immigrants on the American frontier, both the work through Kramer with the colonies in the Saginaw Valley, and then finally with the sending of the emergency helpers, the first two, of course, being Adam Ernst and Georg Berger. They present themselves for candidates for service on the American frontier. Leah provides very basic formation and training in Neuendettelsau. They are sent to the United States. At first, they go to the Columbus Seminary of the Ohio Synod. That doesn't work out. It seems to be promising, but Leah does not finally approve of Ohio's lax confessionalism and their use of basically the Prussian Union communion formula. And so he sends his men instead in the direction of the Saxons. Leah was very, very much familiar with kind of the contours, the landscape of American Lutheranism in this period, knows something of Grabaugh, knows something of Walther, and his men have very positive contact with Walther. They're involved in a meeting in Cleveland that will be one of the events that lead toward the formation of the Missouri Synod. In fact, when the Missouri Synod is formed, there are more Leah men there than there are Saxons, even though Walther himself will clearly emerge as the theological and organizational leader of the Synod. At the organizing convention of the Missouri Synod, a resolution was passed asking Leah to transfer the Fort Wayne Seminary to the Synod while at the same time continuing to support the institution with funds and books. Leah replied affirmatively to that request with three provisions. One, that the seminary serve only the Lutheran Church that accepts the entire Book of Concord. Two, only German will be used in instruction. We've kind of lapsed there. That's the reason we have my colleagues Ziegler and Schultz on faculty, so that Neuendettelsau doesn't recall the property here or something. It's working so far. And three, the seminary will not alter its mission of speedy preparation of pastors for German-speaking congregations, but again, we strike out there, too. The seminary was out of his hands, but perhaps the seminary in Fort Wayne would be his greatest contribution, his greatest gift to the Missouri Synod. Leah had reservations about the constitutional foundation of the Synod from the beginning. He was especially uneasy regarding the notion of equal representation of clergy and laity in church governance. This seemed to him to reflect a democratic form of church life more reflective of American principles than the ecclesiology of the New Testament. Such a democratic approach, Leah feared, would subordinate the pastor to the will of the congregation. But at this early stage, Leah was unwilling to protest too strongly, believing that over time the weakness of this approach would be realized and appropriate adjustments be made in the Constitution. We had to wait, I guess, until this past summer for those adjustments. Whether they are appropriate or not, you can judge. In the months after the Constituting Convention, Leah expressed his reservations in a number of letters. In a letter to Walther, September 1847, Leah writes, "With heartfelt sorrow, we have noted that your synodical constitution, as it now stands, could not completely meet the model of the first congregations. And we fear, certainly with complete justification, that the fundamental strong mixing of democratic, independent, congregational principles in your constitution will cause greater damage than the mixing of princes and secular authorities in our homeland. Careful attention to many teachings of the Holy Apostle about the organization of the church and the pastors in general would have taught the dear lay brethren something different. A constitution is a dogmatic adiaphron, but not a practical one." And a few months later, in a letter to his German pastoral colleague, Ludwig Adolf Petri, Leah writes, "One thing is regrettable when our good people arrive over there and breathe the American air, they become imbued with democracy, and one hears with amazement how independent and congregational they think about church organization. They are in danger of forgetting the high divine honor of their office and becoming slaves to their congregations." These letters point to a conflict that would emerge in the coming years and ultimately lead to a rift between Leah and the synod that he helped to father. I have a section here, but again, I think I'm going to need to omit it on account of time, about Leah's understanding of Grabeau and his ill-fated attempt to provide some kind of mediation between Walther and Grabeau. Conflict that was still going on, of course, at the time of the 1580 convention of the Missouri Synod. And it's in that 1580 convention that the Synod, or excuse me, 1850, get the dates wrong here, 1850 convention of the Synod. You see, the Reformation was, or the Missouri Synod was pre-Reformational after all. But at the 1850 convention, the Missouri Synod requested Walther to prepare a document clearly stating the Synod's position on church and office. And that it is this same convention that invited and petitioned Leah to visit the States in order to inspect the field cultivated by his labor and to have an opportunity to meet with Walther and his associates to discuss these questions of church and ministry. Due to circumstances in Bavaria, Leah declined this invitation. In a letter to Winneken dated February 13, 1851. And sometimes Leah is faulted for not accepting the invitation. I think a number of reasonable explanations, though, can be offered. Hans Schwartz suggests that Leah was simply tight. He didn't want to spend the money. And that is actually borne out with an examination of how Leah related to the colonists and also to the early Iowa Synod. He demanded an accounting of every penny. And he was not given, really, I think, to spend money on what he would see as a very expensive trip. But I think even the more pressing reason is that Leah is engaged in the height of a theological battle with the Bavarian church. And it is unclear at this point whether he would be even allowed to remain in the church or whether he would withdraw from the territorial church. And so it was simply not a good time for him to take several months and make a trip to North America. So the synod meeting in 1851, later that year, deputized Walther and Winneken to travel to Neuendettelsau to meet with Leah in order to address what appeared to be a growing rift. And I would just mention here that the travel journals, Walther's travel journals are in the Harrison volume at Home in the House of My Fathers, a very, very interesting reading and reflections on how Walther goes to Germany with a great deal of apprehension. And yet he says when he steps to Leah's door, Leah warmly receives him into the parsonage. Winneken preaches at the church in Neuendettelsau. They are clearly co-confessors. They are together. And it's in many ways a very very touching kind of story. Well, when Winneken and Walther arrive in Germany in 1851, they also see the ramifications of the struggle that Leah is involved in with the upper consistory of the Bavarian church. Leah and others are threatened with suspension for their insistence that the territorial church cease and desist in admitting the reform to the sacrament. The Missourian stood with Leah in his insistence on the closure of Lutheran altars to the Reformed, even though this stance would come at the price of foregoing potential financial support from Bavaria. Walther reports on his meetings with Leah. They are strikingly positive. Just prior to departing Germany, Walther wrote a letter of thanks to Leah stating, "I can and must confess to you that the unhappy prejudices with which I entered your house have completely dissipated, that I am taking with me a heartfelt trust in your fidelity to our dear Lutheran Church, and the strongest conviction of the unity of the Spirit in which we Lutherans in North America stand with you. I have seen how precious the welfare of our church, which is largely a plant of your faithful care, lies in your heart. Therefore, I do not have to beg you to do all your conscience will permit, that our orphan church in America may be ever able to extol her closest unity with you before the whole world." And upon his return to the States, Walther praises Leah in the May 25th, 1852 issue of Der Lutheraner. "We may assure our dear readers that a reconciliation in the truth and in love has by the grace of God been attained." which is of far greater value than one which gets its guarantee from a subscription to a certain strictly formulated thesis attained through insistent demands. And likewise, Leah gives a positive evaluation of his time with Walther and Winnicott. He lauds the fraternal love and goodwill expressed by his Missouri visitors. Such a spirit requires no haste to become one in formulas and theses. Hand in hand they go to the school of the Holy Spirit, where they see over the doorway the inscription, "The longer, the more love, the longer, the greater unity and faithfulness." Leah extols the progress made. We do have a common fundamental concept of the church. We are one in the acknowledgement of a divinely instituted pastoral office. The practice of our American brethren is known to us and recognized by us as altogether good and proper, so that we joyfully desire to and shall send our students to them and none other. We repeatedly found ourselves acknowledging to each other that we are fundamentally one. Leah also includes a reproof of Grabaugh's reckless handling of excommunication and rebukes his harsh words against the Missourians. Leah adds that he renders this judgment against Grabaugh on his own accord and that he is not doing this at the prompting of his guest. Now, neither Walther nor Leah thought that all the disputed points had been resolved. Leah lists 4 points he believes that his American counterparts need to address. First, the relationship of the visible church to the invisible church, and the necessity of a living expression and form of the invisible church in a visible structure. Second, the God-pleasing connection of the individual congregation with the whole church, the presentation of the doctrine of the body and its members in this pilgrim church, and three, the difference between law and apostolic injunction, or instruction, excuse me, or institution. Difference between law and apostolic institution, and the full recognition of the latter for guidance in the visible church, and for the proper recognition of the progress and victory of the Lutheran church in the pietistic and related controversies of the previous centuries. In this same article, Leah describes his intention to remain with the Missouri Synod, support the Missouri Synod, but he also reserves for himself a certain independence for future activities in the States. Coupled with the disputed theological issues of church and office, friction had developed in Saginaw that would ultimately lead to the break between Leah and Walther. In addition to the 4 colonies Leah had established in Michigan, he established a teacher's seminary in Saginaw in 1852. The Michigan seminary, unlike the Fort Wayne Institution, was not handed over to the Missouri Synod. The director of the seminary, Georg Grossman, in fact elected not to affiliate with the Missouri Synod, even though he was a member of Holy Cross Congregation. Grossman was involved in a dispute with another layman, Ottomer Clater, who was the pastor at Holy Cross. The dispute had to do on one level with the doctrine of church and ministry. On another level, it had to do with territory and property. There were also tensions surrounding the last of the Leah colonies established in Michigan, Frankenhut, under the leadership of Pastor Johannes Deinendorfer, who remained sympathetic to Leah's position on church and ministry. James Schaff observes the actual incidents in the Michigan colonies, which led to the break with Missouri, are shrouded in silence. The participants were loath to discuss the painful details and contented themselves with presenting generalities. Apparently, no one single item led to the decision to leave Michigan. The final break was a result of hard feelings and dissatisfaction, which had been building for years. The break came in 1853, the summer of 1853. Grossman and Deinendorfer decided to relocate to Iowa. Leah sends a letter to Ferdinand Sievers, bordered in black, noting the death of his own mother just a month before, but also, he says, noting his sorrow at this conflict. The letter rebukes the Missourians for what Leah here identifies as their papistical territorialism. The controversy in Saginaw was between three young men. All three of these men were in their 20s, and they were all sent by Leah. Plater had arrived in 1849. Deinendorfer came in 1851 and was followed by Grossman the next year. How is it that Leah's emissaries came to find themselves in conflict with one another? Siegfried Habert suggests that Leah's doctrine of the ministry actually evolved in four distinct periods. The first period would have been the early years of Leah's work up until 1841. In this period, Leah's views on the office are reflective of the Lutheran dogmaticians of the 17th century. A second period, stretching from 1841 to 1848, included the publication of the three books about the church, 1845. And it was in this period that Leah seeks to demonstrate how the invisible church is made visible. And we should also note that it is in this period, at the end of this period, that we have the Revolution of 1848, which would serve, I think, to draw out from Leah a very strong conservative and anti-democratic response. The third period, which runs from 1848 to 1860, this period is marked by the aphorismen of 1849 and 1851, where Leah becomes more innovative and uses the language of spiritual aristocracy to describe the clergy. And the final stage, according to Habert, 1861 to the end of his life, 1872, Leah does not contribute anything new or different to the discussion of the office. In light of Habert's characterization of Leah's theological development, James Schaff's conclusion that Leah's early emissaries were steeped in the earlier teaching of their mentor and did not find his later position congenial, while Grossman and Deinendorfer would have been trained in the newly developing insights of their teacher. That would account for a conflict between men who were all sent from Neuendettelsau. After this break, there will be some occasional contact between the Missourians and their former mentor. For example, Johann Streckfuss wrote Leia saying that he did not wish to be counted among his ungrateful pupils. Sievers and Ernst are among those who remain on amicable terms with Leia. Friedrich Winneken's son, H.C. Winneken, took an extended trip to Germany in 1869 and 1870. In his diary from June 23, 1869, he writes of his visit with the aging Pastor Leia. "I will not forget how he greeted me with a warm handshake and a sweet melancholy smile after having read my name on Mr. Volk's card. And my heart ached when he said, 'Yes, there is a friendship between me and your father,' which seems to have been forgotten, though. My silly heart's emotion only allowed me to say, 'No, not at all. I have retained my immense love and respect for this man from the very first moment I saw him.'" The reception of Leia in the Missouri Synod in the latter part of the 19th century cannot be fully understood apart from the emergence of the Iowa Synod, established in 1854 by those who departed Saginaw. Led by Deinendorfer and Grossman, a band of about 20 settlers established a congregation and colony, St. Sebald, in Clayton County, Iowa. This group would become the nucleus of the Iowa Synod, dedicated to maintain Leah's teaching and to fulfill his vision of a missionary post on the American frontier. Even though the Iowa Synod had its genesis in the controversy over the ministerial office, the new synod would not finally be able to implement Leah's view. In fact, Todd Nickel has demonstrated that the Iowa Synod embodied much of Leah's legacy, but not his doctrine of the ministry. The Iowa Synod, its history makes clear, learned much at the knee of Wilhelm Leia, but not his doctrine of the ministry. Like its synodical counterparts in the 19th century, Iowa drew its understanding of the ordained ministry from a fresh reading of Scripture, from the Lutheran confessions, and from the history of the wider Lutheran tradition. The Synod's leading theologians indeed developed their views on the ministry on the basis of a new consideration of the source of Christian and Lutheran traditions and in the light of considerable practical experience of church life in the United States. On the basis of this theological study and experience, they self-consciously entered into what they regarded not only as an American Lutheran consensus, but as a consensus representing the Lutheran tradition as a whole. In the remaining years of the 19th century, free conferences and literary exchanges between Iowa and Missouri gravitated toward other issues, including the scope of confessional subscription and eschatology, but especially toward the matter of open questions. Leah had maintained that the doctrine of church and ministry was left unsettled by the confessions and therefore was open to greater development and clarification. Walther and the Missourians were ultimately unwilling to concede this point. Hence, they could develop a polity at variance with Leah's own preference in their new context. It is interesting to note that years after the break in Saginaw, Deinendorfer would write in the setting of another controversy, this time predestination, that while the office of ministry was an open question, election is not. He says, although in former years the difference between us and Missouri did not stand in the way of church fellowship, the difference now existing in the doctrine of predestination is of such a nature that there can no longer be any church fellowship. The older Leah was able to recognize shifts and changes within his own thinking that would put him at odds, not only with the Missourians, but with other confessionally minded Lutherans in Germany. At a pastoral conference in 1865, he states, "Formerly for me, to be a Lutheran meant to confess the symbols from A to Z. Now all of Lutheranism is wrapped up for me in the sacrament of the altar. It is not so much the Lutheran doctrine about the Holy Supper, but sacramental living and the experience of the blessing of the sacrament, which is made possible only through frequent participation. This is now the main thing for me. My progress is summed up in the words sacramental Lutheranism." The final 20 years of Leah's life were especially focused on the Deaconess House. It is in this context that he writes, "If you want to know what we really desired, you have only to look at the Deaconess Institution. But you should not think only of the sisters. We wanted an apostolic episcopal church of brothers. Lutheranism is not part of the matter for us. What makes us Lutheran with all our soul is the sacrament of the altar and the doctrine of justification. We are not Lutherans in the sense of the Missourians, nor of the old Lutherans. We are very old and very modern. What we really wanted in the final instance, was for a Lutheranism to progress to an apostolic episcopal church of brothers." Leah's vision of an apostolic episcopal church of brothers was never realized in Germany, and it was not realized in the Missouri or the Iowa synods. And the dream of such a church, along with his eschatological speculations, would make him increasingly suspect in the Missouri Synod. Even as Missouri's understanding of doctrine and confessional subscription would come under fire in the Iowa Synod, so Leah and his American heirs would come to criticism by the Missourians in the remaining two decades of his life. So that when Leah dies in 1872, his death is announced in the February 15 issue of Der Lutheraner with little comment. From Lutherische Zeitung, we learn the shocking news that Pastor Leah of Neuendettelsau, after a brief illness, died at 5:45 o'clock on the evening of January 2nd. The significance of Leah's work was often overlooked in the first 100 years of the Missouri Synod's history. Writing in 1944, Theodore Grebner includes a chapter on Leah in his book, Church Bells in the Forest, The Story of Lutheran Pioneer Work on the Michigan Frontier, 1840 to 1850. There is a scant but positive reference to Leah in Bepler's A Century of Grace. All the references to Leah in Pieper's Christian Dogmatics are negative, referring to him as one who is given to Romanizing tendencies. And commentary given in Lera and Vera, second half of the 19th century, also negative. It is only in the 1950s and 60s that a more appreciative picture of Leah begins to emerge in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. This, in part, may come from the influence of Hermann Sasse. Remember, Sasse himself came to a confessional Lutheran position through his reading of three books about the church when he was a graduate student at Hartford Seminary in the academic year 1925 and 2026. And I think more could be made of this point in terms of how Sasse was somewhat of a catalyst for thinking in the Missouri Synod in the 1950s. But again, we're going to have to go on there. While there seems to be some parallel in the thinking of Arthur Carl Peepcorn to Leah, especially in relationship to ecclesiology and the Lord's Supper, as far as I can tell, Peepcorn never produced any published essay dealing with Leah in depth. In his Profiles in Belief, Volume 2, Peepcorn does speak of Leah, identifying him as one who argued that the confessional position of the Church of the Augsburg Confession is identical with that of the New Testament. He could therefore also affirm the Catholicity and ecumenical nature of the Lutheran confessions. A number of Peepcorn students, however, would go on to write on Leah. 1954, John Tejan would submit a STM thesis at Union Seminary on the ecclesiology of Wilhelm Leah. Walter Bowman wrote his doctoral dissertation in 1962 on the unity of the church in 19th century Lutheranism for Edmund Schlink at Heidelberg. And in that thesis, he devotes a substantial section to Leah. Bowman examines the ecclesial thinking of 14 German Lutheran theologians of the 19th century, probing their articulation of the nature and unity of the church. Among them is Leah. Bowman observes that Leah seeks the church's perfection, that is, the invisible church being made visible, the church militant becoming more and more like the church triumphant. Leah is identified as being a representative of an Irenic ecumenical Lutheranism. He credits Leah for speaking of the Catholicity of the Lutheran Church as it takes the middle place among the denominations. The category of open questions provides space for growth and development. Bowman notes Leah's preference for the imagery of Romanticism in describing the periods of the church as blossoms on a flower. While not attempting to equate his own view with that of Leah, Bowman does see several aspects of Leah's ecclesiology as providing resource and reserve for ecumenical efforts. Bowman concludes, but perhaps the discussion of the 19th century, still unresolved today, indicates that this is in need of further dogmatic definition. Perhaps the Confessio Augustana has only made a beginning. Perhaps the dogmatic definition of the church is still before us, still before the whole of Christendom. That is not to say that Bowman finds Leah without difficulty. For example, he sees in Leah's thinking an identification of the apostolic word with scripture rather than preaching. Nor does he think that Leah was able to sufficiently work out the ecclesiological significance of an already existing unity. Beyond his dissertation, Bowman would not provide any additional work on Leah. Before he leaves the Missouri Synod in 1977 for a teaching position at the Columbus Seminary of the American Lutheran Church, Bowman was a vocal participant in efforts to increase ecumenical participation and liturgical renewal within the Missouri Synod. The remainder of his career, spent in the ALC and then the ELCA, would be marked by his aggressive advocacy of called to common mission, which would establish full communion between the ELCA and the Episcopal Church in 1999. Bowman identified himself as an evangelical Catholic. Although this term is elusive and elastic, David Radke suggests that Leah's theology reveals a marked similarity to this movement. Most significantly, perhaps, Kenneth Corby authored his dissertation on theology of pastoral care in Wilhelm Leah with special attention to the function of the liturgy and the laity. Corby submitted the dissertation to Concordia Seminary in Exile in 1976. For many years, a professor at Valparaiso University, and then a parish pastor, while he also served as adjunct professor at this school, Corby stimulated a renewed interest in Leah. His instruction of future deaconesses at Valparaiso connected them with the diaconal tradition of Noen Dedalcel. As an adjunct professor at Fort Wayne and frequent conference lecturer in the 1980s and 1990s, Corby challenged stereotypical renderings of Leah and presented Leah as a model for pastoral theology and mission in contrast to the therapeutic approaches of pastoral counseling and church growth paradigms for mission that were becoming increasingly popular in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Among other things, Corby urged a recovery of the practice of confession and absolution as the seat of pastoral care, following again approach of Leah. One can also detect the imprint of images drawn from Leah in Corby's own writings and especially in his preaching. In 1964, Eric Heinzen authored a doctoral dissertation for the University of Illinois on Wilhelm Leah and the Missouri Synod, 1841 to 1853. Heinzen concludes his dissertation with Walther's tribute to Leah in 1852. Next to God, it is only Pastor Leah to whom our synod is indebted for its happy beginning and rapid growth in which it now rejoices. It may well honor him as its spiritual father. It would fill the pages of an entire book to recount even briefly what for many years this man, with tireless zeal and the noblest unselfish spirit, has done for our Lutheran Church and our Synod in particular. Then significantly, Heinzen writes, these words, it is true, were written when the romance between Leah and the Synod, though threatened, was still in bloom. After it faded, such acknowledgments became noticeably restrained and Leah gradually forgotten. The tribute, however, still remains what it was. Like any monument, though largely ignored, it stands for all to see if they will but look. A condensed version of Heinzen's dissertation appeared in print in 1973 as Love Leaves Home, Wilhelm Leah and the Missouri Synod. And there's also a significant body of kind of popular literature, much of that literature associated with Frankenmuth, that would provide popular access to Leah. For much of the Missouri Synod's history, the significance of the pastor from Neuen Dedalcel has only been partly appreciated. At worst, Leah was characterized as guilty of Romanizing tendencies. More generous assessments would recognize his early assistance in providing human and financial resources that would be crucial for the development of what would become the Missouri Synod. And I see the gatekeeper standing at the door. I have a section of the paper that speaks about some of the ways in which Leah has been recovered, most recently in the Geiger biography, just translated and published by CPH. Some comments on his his influence also in a Lutheran service book. But we're running out of time, so let me simply conclude with the final paragraph. Leah's voice has never been absent in Walther's church. Sometimes it has been a muted voice, barely heard. Yet Leah played an important role as from across the Atlantic. He would send men and resources, helping them to shape the identity of the fledgling synod. In more recent years, various aspects of Leah's legacy have been retrieved in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in efforts to broaden ecumenical perspective, deepen pastoral theology, enrich liturgical life, give shape to an authentically Lutheran missiology, enhance the place of the female diaconate, sustain the church's corporate life of mercy, or to provide what is seen as a corrective to Walther's understanding of the office. In his review of the reception of Leah in Germany, Diedrich Blaufuss has noted attempts to render the Bavarian churchman either a saint or a heretic, often without serious engagement of Leah's own literary work. A fresh engagement with Leah's work, which seeks to make of him neither a villain nor an unflawed hero, is to be welcomed as an appropriate way to appreciate his legacy alongside that of Walther and to make critical use of it for fostering the life and mission of the Lutheran Church in our own day. Thank you.